Hi. Oh, oh. There's, sorry, my son has entered the picture here. Hang on. Get him forcibly removed. And there he goes. Okay. Hi. Welcome to Hemingway's tonight. Thank you all for coming by and tuning in with us here on our Zoom series for the season. Thank you so much to Halsey and to everybody at White Whale for really making this season happen. We honestly could not have done this without them. So we're so happy to be partnered with them. So again, thank you. And thank you to all the readers tonight. So in 4th of July is coming up this weekend. So in lieu of any serious introduction, I'm just going to read a baseball poem. My favorite baseball poem, which is by the poet B.H. Fairchild. And it's called Body and Soul. And I actually have an audience here tonight because Jason Irwin is sitting next to me. So I'll read to Jason as well. Half numb, guzzling bourbon and coke from coffee mugs, our fathers fall in love with their own stories, nuzzling the facts up, but mauling the truth. And my friend's father begins to lay out with the slow ease of a blues ballad, a story about sandlot baseball in Commerce, Oklahoma, decades ago. These were men's teams, grown men, some in their 30s and 40s who worked together in zinc mines or on oil rigs, sweat and khaki and long beers after work, steel guitar music wanging in their ears, little white rent houses to return to where their wives complained about money and broken Kenmores and then said the hell with it and sang Body and Soul in the bathtub. And later that evening with the kids asleep, lay in bed stroking their husband's wrist tattoo and smoking Chesterfields from a fresh pack until everything was okay. Well, you get the idea. Life goes on. The next day is Sunday. Another ball game and the other team shows up one man short. They say we're one man short, but can we use this boy? He's only 15 years old and at least he'll make a game. They take a look at the kid. Muscular and kind of knowing, the way he holds his glove, with the shoulders loose, the thick neck, but then with that boy's face under a clump of angelic blonde hair, and say, oh hell, sure, let's play ball. So it all begins, the men loosening up, joking about the fat catcher's sex life. It's so bad, last night he had to hump his wife, that sort of thing. Pairing off into little games to catch that heat up into throwing matches. The smack of the fungo bat, lazy jogging into right field, big smiles and arcs of tobacco juice, and the talk that gives a cool, easy feeling to the air. Talk among men normally silent, normally brittle, and a little angry with the empty promise of their lives. But they chatter and say, rock and fire, babe, easy out, and go right ahead and pitch to the boy. But nothing fancy. Just hard fastballs right around the belt. And the kid takes the first two, but on the third, pops the bat around so quick and sure that they pause a moment before turning around to watch the ball still rising and finally dropping far beyond the abandoned tractor that marks left field. Holy shit. They're pretty quiet watching around the bases, but then what the hell? The kid knows how to hit a ball. So what? Let's play some goddamn baseball here. And so it goes. The next time up, the boy gets a look at a very nifty low curve, then a slider, and the next one is the curve again. And he sends it over the Alice Chalmers, high and big and sweet. The left fielder just stands there, frozen. As if this isn't enough, the next time up, he bats left-handed. They can't believe it. And the pitcher, a tall, mean-faced man from Okarchi, who just doesn't give a shit anyway because his wife ran off 2 years ago, leaving him with three little ones in a rusted out Dodge with a cracked block, leans in hard, looking at the fat catcher like he was the son of a bitch who ran off with his wife. Leans in and throws something out of the dark green hell of forbidden fastballs, something that comes in at the knees and then leaps viciously towards the kid's elbow. He swings exactly the way he did right-handed, and they all turn like a chorus line toward deep right field where the ball loses itself in sagebrush and the sad burnt dust of Dust Bowl, Oklahoma. It is something to see. But why make a long story long? Runs pile up on both sides. The boy comes around five times, and five times the pitcher is cursing both God and his mother as his chew of tobacco sours into something resembling horse piss. And a ragged and bruised Spalding baseball disappears into the far horizon. Good night, Irene. They have lost the game in some painful side bets, and they have been suckered. And it means nothing to them, though it should to you, when they are told the boy's name is Mickey Mantle. And that's the story, and those are the facts. But the facts are not the truth. I think, though, as I scan the faces of these old men now lost in the innings of their youth, I think I know what the truth of this story is, and I imagine it lying there in the weeds behind that Alice Chalmers, just waiting for the obvious question to be asked. Why, oh, why in hell didn't they just throw around the kid? Walk him after he hit the third homer. Anybody would have, especially nine men with disappointed wives and dirty socks and diminishing expectations for whom winning at anything meant everything. Men who knew how to play the game, who had talent when the other team had nothing except this ringer, who without a pitch to hit was meaningless, and they could go home with their little $2 side bets and stride into the house, singing, "If you've got the money, honey, I've got the time," with a bottle of Southern Comfort under their arms and grab Dixie or Mayella up and dance across the gray linoleum as if it were V-Day all over again. But they did not. And they did not because they were men and this was a boy. And they did not because sometimes after making love, after smoking their Chesterfields in the cool silence and listening to the big bands on the radio that sounded so glamorous, so distant, they glanced over at their wives and noticed the lines growing heavier around the eyes and mouth. Felt what their wives felt, that Les Brown and Glenn Miller and all those dancing couples, and in fact, all possibility of human gaiety and lightheartedness were as far away and unreachable as Times Square or the Avalon Ballroom. They did not because of the gray linoleum lying there in the half dark, the free calendar from the local mortuary that said one day was pretty much like another, the work gloves looped over the doorknob like dead squirrels. And they did not because they had gone through a depression and a war that had left them with the idea that being a man in the eyes of their fathers and everyone else had cost them just too goddamn much to lay it at the feet of a 15-year-old boy. And so they did not walk in and lost, but at least had some ragged remnant of themselves to take back home. But there is one thing more, though it is not a fact. When I see my friend's father staring hard into the bottomless well of home plate as Mantle's fifth homer heads toward Arkansas, I know that this man, with a half-orphaned children and worthless dodge, has also encountered for his first and possibly only time the vast gap between talent and genius, has seen as few have in the harsh light of an Oklahoma Sunday, the blonde and blue-eyed bringer of truth, who will not easily be forgiven. Thanks for listening to that, and let's play ball.